Okay, okay. When you first started out, well, first of all, when did you start practicing medicine?
Let me see. I graduated from medical school in 1957. And I did a year of internship. Then I did a 3-year residency in adult psychiatry, and then a 2-year residency in child psychiatry. So let me see when that would be. Probably around 1961.
Okay. Where did you go to medical school?
Howard University in Washington, D.C.
And you did your residency?
I did it two places. I did my first year of adult residency at in Washington, St. Elizabeth's Hospital. And then the second and third years were done at Worcester State Hospital. And then I did the 2 years of child here in Worcester, too.
So you've been in Worcester since that time?
Yeah.
Okay. And what was it like being a female physician here in Worcester at that time?
I think that there weren't a lot of female physicians, and because I was in psychiatry, I think I was removed from contact with a lot of the physicians. I didn't have many colleagues.
Right.
Yeah. There were a few, perhaps, female physicians in training with me that I kept in contact with, but there was not a large peer group.
How did you deal with that? Did you find that to be a problem, or what did you do to kind of build a support system for yourself?
Right. Well, I think when I went to medical school, there were very few women in medicine. So out of the class of 75, there were 6 female. So I began in the field being in a situation where there were very few women.
Okay.
I think the same is true of my internship and residency. So I think I wasn't. It wasn't fine to me to be in a situation where there were a few women.
Right.
But I think I certainly built a support group of the other trainees, whether it was my internship or residency program. And then I had a lot of family support through the years. But I think you enter the field back then knowing that there's very few women in the field.
Right. So how I'm sure your experience here was very different from your experience in D.C.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I think in Worcester you were not only female, you were minority. I think that there were some situations that you were in that you needed to appreciate that there were some people you may be treating who had not been exposed to a female physician or a black physician, and you would have to take that into consideration and either help the patient to deal with that or move forward. I think I ran into very few situations when we weren't able to work it out.
Okay.
And I tried to encourage patients that I came in contact with to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they probably found it more comfortable to talk about you're a woman than you're a black woman.
Mm-hmm.
But, there were very few situations, I think, that we didn't talk it out or people felt they had to request a change or whatever.
Did you find that you had problems with that also among your colleagues here when you came here to Worcester?
Well, I think, again, back then, you really had to be assertive with your male colleagues. And, I think you had to be prepared for certain assumptions that they had, one of them being, you're sort of taking the place of another male physician because you're just going to have a family and drop out, and you really aren't serious about the practice of medicine, I think, was something that people thought about back in those days. So I think you had to continue, and I did. I did have a family. I did have children. So I remember one of my supervisors said that, I think you're practicing medicine is really a hobby.
Oh, really? Wow. This was a supervisor.
This is my supervisor. Yeah. So I think you had to deal with that. Mm-hmm. But. Thinking that you really weren't serious about medicine.
When you came to Worcester, how did hospitals and other group practices treat black physicians at the time?
Well, I think they were, it was not easy to get on hospital staff. And I think they had very few minorities on any of the hospital staffs, really. Whether it be, there were psychiatric units at Memorial and St. Vincent's.
Okay.
And it wasn't easy to get on the hospital staff. I think they were very rigid.
Do you feel like the situation has changed?
Well, I think so. I think much more it's based on your credentials and your experience and what you're going to contribute versus whether you're a minority or not. I think that's really changed in Worcester.
Let's see. So how do you, and you're into your child psychiatry.
Right.
So what do you find about the population in Worcester here in terms of children and things that they deal with? Is it any different? Do you notice it, think it's any different from other places? Or?
Well, I think there's certainly, the minority population in Worcester is less, but still I think some of the great percentage of minorities were poor, and you find problems with children and families are increased when the families are poor, so that you find more an increase in, I think, mental health problems in minority populations. But I think some of the same problems are evident in Worcester as elsewhere. We're a little different from the big inner city like in Washington or Boston, but still I think we have kids who are abused and neglected and families who are struggling to get along. You have multi-problem dysfunctional families. So I think some of the same issues that you find across the nation are true here in Worcester, probably just not as great a proportion.
Just on a smaller
scale. Yeah.
Yes. And I'm just curious, do you find that I know that Worcester has a large Latino population. Do
right.
you find the similar problems between the Latino children and the white children, the black children? It seems mental health problems and issues with child rearing would be pretty much be the same across
yeah.
the board with children.
I think we find with some of our Latino families that they have an additional burden, and sometimes the parents speak only Spanish and most of the young people that grow up in Worcester are bilingual,
mm-hmm.
but I think they are new to this culture,
mm-hmm.
and we have a program that has bilingual, bicultural therapists that tries to appreciate the differences that families have with growing up in Worcester. So I think they have a bigger burden, in a sense, they're minority, and they have a different culture and a different language. So that, some of the mental health problems we see are increased in the Hispanic population. I think a lot of poor Hispanic families come to live in Worcester. And so they have to deal with not being poor, being different culture, different language. So I think we're finding, many more Hispanic families with probably more problems than black families.
And do you see here at Worcester Youth Guidance, what's the proportion of patients you see from the different ethnic backgrounds here?
I think it's probably higher than the general population. The black population in Worcester is really very small. The Hispanic population is now greater than the black population. So I think we perhaps a little bit higher than the population in Worcester.
Mm-hmm.
We get referred cases. And I think because we have a specific program for black and Hispanic clients that probably get referred more. And we also have programs that outreach into the communities. So I can remember years ago, Hispanic population didn't want to come here for mental health services. And we spent, I think, a number of years reaching out into the community, collaborating with other organizations that work with the Hispanic population. So I think we're thought of well in the Hispanic community. And so now we have many more referrals than we have Hispanic therapists to deal with those referrals. And I think, the black population, we have had to work at them feeling comfortable in this setting, even though we have black staff members, that, we needed to convince the black population that we were really interested in helping
right.
the kids. So we have some early intervention prevention programs. In fact, one is going on this week. It's a school vacation enrichment project that youngsters 9 to 11, about 40 of them, participate in 4 days of activity, that sort of life skills activity and recreation. And they're off on a recreational activity this afternoon. But that has sort of established us over the past 5 to 6 years. We're sort of giving something to the black community. and we get lots of referrals from the black community now.
You touched on something that I was just thinking of, that I know in the black community, psychiatry kind of has a stigma around it all in itself, so it probably was very difficult to gain the trust of the population.
Yeah, I think very much so. So I think, we have a couple of staff members who people know and can call up and ask for help, and, we advocate in the school, so I think people feel somewhat more comfortable. I think we still run into that situation, though, that people are leery of mental health work, and some families want us to fix the kids and hesitate for themselves to be involved, and we're a very family-oriented agency that, we feel in order to help kids, we really need to elicit the support of the entire family and to make the context in which the kids live a little bit better. So sometimes it's easier for them to just fix my kid and for them to trust us and have confidence in us, that they're willing to kind of share some of the problems in their families we've had to work toward.
Do you have a large involvement with the school system as well?
We do. We do a lot of collaboration with the school system. I think that's really a very important part of our work, to have everybody working together on behalf of the kids. So we do a lot of advocacy and, working with the schools. And we have a few special programs with schools really working together. We're involved in a school loop project with Granite Street School, and we're involved in another project with preschool kids who are already in special ed, tying the work with the parents with what the school is doing.
So you've been in Worcester for quite some time.
Oh, a long time,
So what keeps you here in Worcester?
Well, my husband grew up and was raised in Worcester.
Okay.
So we came back to live here because his family was here. His father was a physician, so we came to live in Worcester. And I think it's a good place for kids to be raised. I think it's, it can be lonely in a way, socially. And I think we have some ties in the Boston area that keeps us, addresses some of our social needs.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's kept us here because it's a good place for kids.
Mm-hmm. You have many children?
I have four.
Four children?
Yeah.
Okay.
So they're all grown at this point. And I'm a grandmother, so that, but I think that's what kept you here,
Yeah.
And, I think for the kids growing up, I think when they got to be teenagers, I think they felt somewhat isolated. And that was the most difficult period for them. And they were juniors and seniors in high school.
Right.
Because although the black population, I think, is just very scattered here in Worcester.
Yeah. And then once you get outside of Worcester, there's few and far between that you find black folks, huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
I have to go to the Boston area.
Right.
And again, I think people just, unless you belong to an organization that brings people together, go to a black church, I think the daily lives in the neighborhoods, people are really spread out.
What about in terms of other black physicians here in Worcester?
There are more black physicians right now. Mm-hmm. There are not many black physicians in Worcester, and I think through the years there was really little getting together of the black physicians in Worcester. I think there was not a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
At one point there may be six or seven black physicians, and now there are many more. And I think even now, the black physicians are tied to more to institutions, and there really isn't a getting together. There's a New England Society of Black Physicians, but that's very Boston-oriented. And I think the Worcester physicians tend not to belong. I used to be active a few years ago. I'm not active now. But I think I probably don't know even some of the black physicians who are here now. Some of them have come in, again, associated with institutions. And now I think even the referral pattern is so very different now than it used to be. Used to know somebody in a particular specialty that you could refer cases to, and everything now is managed care driven. So it's not quite, a referral back and forth. That's the managed care company does that.
So if you knew a physician that you felt was, would meet the needs of your patient, you were able to pass them on to that physician. There's more of a structure. How does it work now? There's more of a structured situation.
Depending on what your insurance coverage is, the panel of physicians that you can seek help from are members of the HMO.
Right.
there's some closed HMOs and some open HMOs. And say, for example, if you belong to Fallon, you can only go to physicians on the Fallon panel. So, and then I think most of the black physicians are associated with institutions. It's harder to, it's harder and harder to be in private practice in Worcester. So that, you know, unless you're a member of a group or...
So here at Worcester Youth Guidance, is this part of one of the HMO groups or this is a...
No, we're a provider for some HMO groups.
Okay.
You know, we receive, we receive some Fallon clients, some Central Mass Healthcare, that's now, what is it, Health Source, Central Mass Healthcare. We have a group provider status that we belong to some HMOs. And I'm on the staff at St. Vincent's Hospital, but that doesn't matter as much anymore because the HMOs need to approve hospitalization. So they would decide where there's a bed and where you should go. And so it's not just that you're on a staff and you can hospitalize your patients at the hospital. It's very different now.
Yeah,
it depends if your patient belongs to an HMO, that HMO really makes that decision.
Do you think that how do you think that affects the care that patients get because they have to kind of stay within, do you think it has an either positive or negative effect on the care they can receive?
I think that that's a hard question. You know, I think supposedly HMOs are managing care so that they're trying to provide the appropriate level of care and the best quality care and ensuring in their system they have multiple levels so that if you don't need to be in the hospital, they have step-down programs or diversion programs. And I think it's hard to say. For some people, it feels like they're not getting adequate care. And that's perhaps on a case-by-case basis. In the field of psychiatry, certainly, I think there's been a move to shorten inpatient care, which I think is very good, and develop alternative modalities to treat more appropriately. But sometimes on the front end, it feels as though, you know, care is limited. So I think in the field of psychiatry, it's a difficult time as HMOs, I think, are trying to structure so they will be providing quality care and appropriate care. But it still feels like some people are not getting appropriate care.
And the population that are here, in general as a whole, do you feel like they're getting the appropriate care based on, I mean, having to go through the HMOs and that sort of thing? Do you feel like that the population of people of color have adequate access to care here in Worcester?
Well, I guess a large proportion of minorities are Medicaid, and they probably have a pretty good access to care. Some Medicaid clients, however, have elected HMOs for their health care, so their mental health care goes along with that. And sometimes the health care is better than HMOs, you know, whereas the mental health care may or may not be better. Because I think years ago, patients were complaining that certain doctors refused their care.
Because they were in
Medicaid.
Okay.
Now I think most doctors accept Medicaid as considered, you know, the payment source is a good payment source. But I think, you know, ideally, I think if the systems work and managed care organizations really were able to effectively manage the care, that would be good. Because I think they would look at the whole family and they would look to have people stay well and prevention and early intervention. And once a person is in the system to really manage their health care, I think the concept is very good. But I think there's still a ways to go in the sense of it really working for all segments of the population.
I was curious to know whether or not you feel, I mean, through your years of experience, you find that for children of color, it's to their advantage to have a psychiatrist of color, or does it matter?
I think it's so individual. You know, I think for some families, I think it's most important that they have someone who they can identify with and who can be more understanding of, I think, the cultural aspects and appreciate some differences in black families. On the other hand, I think more and more people are thinking cross-culturally and realizing that you can work with somebody not like yourself if you take a step back and try to appreciate
and try to understand. But I think for some families it does make a difference. And I think the whole trust issue, some families' experience has been such that they are really not trusting of others who are not like themselves. And I think they avoid or postpone care. So I think for some families it's really important, but others it's not. And again, I think the more that everybody in the field can appreciate the importance of thinking in a cross-cultural way, that people will be more adequately served. I think you still have people who don't think in that way and are not appreciative of cultural things. So I think the whole field still has a ways to go. And hopefully that's being incorporated in the training now. I hope it is, that people think in that way.
When you were going through your training, was it common not to have a broader, more diverse presentation of different psychiatric issues?
I think it wasn't thought of.
Right. Okay. So did you have to go and kind of investigate those things yourself, or did you find that you incorporated them as you began your residency training and that sort
of thing? Yeah, I think incorporated, and I think just talking with some experiences of your colleagues, that I think some of them who are not minorities could appreciate the difficulties in working with say, minority families. And I think on an individual basis, we're open to hearing, well, maybe there's another way to approach it, or maybe a certain patient may work better with somebody like themselves. So I think individuals were open to that, but I think it certainly wasn't a part of the training.
What types of advice would you give to younger physicians of color who are, you know, coming along, like myself, who are looking for guidance and what to expect?
I think although the world is very different now than when I came along, I think it's still, you have to realize that you may be in situations that there's prejudice, and either both from colleagues, from professors, and from patients, that people may judge you based on the color of your skin or putting you in sort of a block and not look at you as individuals. I think that hasn't gone completely away, and I think you need to be, you need to not forget that. You know, I think you need to be assertive enough, but not be crushed if you're in a situation like that, and not take it so personally. You know, and really try to understand that and go around it. You know, I think there's still some people who have a hard time with women in medicine and with minorities. You know, in terms of yes, you're a competent person,
mm-hmm.
and there's still prejudiced people out there. That hasn't gone away completely. And I think depending on where you were raised or what your background was, you know, I've known some young people who are just shocked and angry to feel that, you know, I'm a professional, I'm competent, I'm well-trained, I've demonstrated that, and I'm still having a hard time. I think that's probably not going to ever, well, not in the foreseeable future, go away. So, you know, I think that, you know, the best way is to try to, if you can deal with it directly, if not, go around it and not have yourself be so angry and immobilized because you run into that, because I think you're going to run into it. In my experience, if you go around it and you can demonstrate that, that you're going to be moving forward and not let that interfere with where you're going, or, you know, one individual see it as an insurmountable roadblock, but realize you may need to, go around it to get other people to support you in your position. But I think it doesn't go completely away. And, but I think you can't be, let that slow you down.
Yeah. And specifically in terms of Worcester, how do you feel the climate is today as it was when you first started in terms of race relations?
I think people are much more open to hearing it, and you know, for some people to say, "Gee, I didn't mean that," or if it came across like that, let me take a look at myself. I think people are much more open in doing that. You know, I think it's certainly listened to if you bring it up, and people don't look at you quite as much. And, you know, you're just trying to give an excuse, or you know, you're blaming racism when you know it's really your problem. I think people are much more open to saying, "Well, let's look at that. You know, let's see what we can do about the situation." I think most people are fairly open, but I think there's going to be the person who's not, and the person who's not going to see it at all if you don't raise it. You know, or I think in very subtle ways. You know, I think too, it's still kind of the good old boy network, and I think for women and minorities, you may not have some of the same opportunities, even social settings on the golf course or whatever, to in the backflapping good old boy. But I think that's still a powerful arena, and sometimes you need to look for opportunities to be social with people, or to realize that that's going on, and opportunities open up that you didn't even know about because somebody knew somebody else in a different way and alerted them to some opportunities that you may not see or may not even know about. Again, I think that's better, but I think it's still there.
I can definitely identify with what you're saying, because it's very easy for me to kind of go through, you know, and not really, and like, and sometimes I can feel like, you know, how do these people know about this certain thing that's going on, or, you know, this opportunity here, and it's basically because it's easy to go on through and not really network like that, which I think is a skill that many people call me to, I know I need to develop more.
And I think to be open to other kinds of networks, too. I know when we were in medical school, there were just a few girls, and way back then there were exams that were passed down, or hints about professors that were passed down, and we sort of had a little girl network that was, you know, the girls in the class before were sure to convey. And I can remember when I first started out, you know, not really realizing that was so important, and that if you weren't in, you didn't know about it. Mm-hmm. I remember feeling, you know, naive me thinking exams passed down, you know, but, you know, 75% of the class had access to that, and you didn't. You were left out. And I think just to little nuances about what you need to do to succeed, and, you know, I don't know what kind of support groups there are now in medical school, and maybe women help other women, but I think there's still, you know, you still have to be aware that it's a sort of good old boy support network, and it's not completely a level playing field. And if you're not aware of that, and you don't look for your opportunities to have special connections, then I think you're being naive.
Yeah,
I
agree. It's important to keep your eyes open, and you have to be aware of what's going on.
That's absolutely true.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah, and even professors, I think, who you know, knowing sort of, you know, what's important to them, and I think it's so important. I think nowadays, I think people are, there used to be a lot of teasing when I came along in medical school and residency. And I think, you know, people don't do that anymore. It would be sexual harassment.
In terms of you being a woman?
Yes. So I think that I hope that stopped. I think people wouldn't dare do anything.
I suppose we'd be surprised what people would do.
But yeah, they'd be put on the carpet for sexual harassment. But, you know, again, I even the facilities, as I think back, because there was such few female staff, you know, they were, you know, not equal.
Yeah. When you were coming through medical school and you were doing your rotations and that sort of thing in the hospitals in D.C., did you find that as a medical student of color, you had, did you have equal access to the same hospitals as your peers did?
Yeah, I think it was the school plan for that as a medical student. It was just, you know, I didn't have to think about that.
Okay.
The school would make arrangements for, maybe there were a couple of rotations that were elective, but for the most part, you know, the school would negotiate that you know, all the students would have, so I didn't think that was not a problem. You know, I think when you went to select your residencies, they were, internships were orchestrated. Residencies weren't so much back then. It was more individual. So you needed to go for interview. Now I think most residency programs are also, you sign up for and you're selected as a part of a big wave. Back then, internships were done that way, but not residences. So then, I would think now it's probably when you get to be chief resident, though, I would think it's still that pyramid.
Yeah.
And I would think there's still a lot of opportunity for selectivity and fuzzy criteria.
Yeah. When you were applying for your internship programs, then,
right.
Did you find it difficult to? I mean, because you did your internships here. Yeah.
I did my internship in Washington.
Okay, that's right.
Yeah.
In Washington.
Right.
And so, was it difficult to enter into that next phase of medical school as a student of color, or was it?
I think it depended on where you. I wanted to stay in the Washington area, so it wasn't difficult so much in Washington area. I think if you wanted to go elsewhere, it perhaps would have been very difficult. The internships were fairly competitive. So, but I think just depending on where you wanted to go. But I know residency programs are perhaps more competitive, and depending on your field, if you wanted to, like surgery or something like that, I think it was very difficult for women in those days. Now I think there are probably very few fields that women haven't demonstrated that they're just as competent,
right.
And I think you can, a lot more fields are more open to you.
I think that's just amazing. I mean, the 1960s, and then you're in medical school, and you're applying for your internships and everything, it just must have been a very intense time.
Yeah, I mean, again, when you think of in my class, out of 75 were women. And I think just the attitude toward women in medicine. You can go into pediatrics and psychiatry, women and psychiatry.
Is that why they try to push the women to
maybe medicine,
right.
But surgery, I think it was.
I
mean, there were women in surgery, but I think they were very few. Now, it'd be interesting to look at those statistics now. I don't know what the statistics are.
I'm not sure. I think that now, I know probably at UMass it's kind of a push, or the general push is toward primary care anyway.
Right, but for the whole medical school. Right.
So, but I think that perhaps there's probably a large proportion of women that go into the primary care fields as well.
Rather than surgery and some of the ultra specialties.
But I'm not sure on the numbers or anything.
I just know there are more female, like orthopedic surgeons, and used to be very few. And women would go into OBGYN, but not orthopedic surgery or neurosurgery or anything like that. They were very, just very, very few women. It took a long time, too, I think, being a student and if you're going to get married or what have you. But now I think many more women are, they're having families and there's some flexibility in the training that you're able to take some time off or go half time. I can remember in my classes there was very little flexibility.
So were you married after medical school? Or
yeah, I got married, graduated from medical school one day, I got married the next.
Wow.
So I finished medical school, and then I did my internship, and I think was during the residency years that I had a couple of kids. Right, and then I had the last two once I was working.
Was it hard to work out the plan to have the children during your time there?
Yeah, it's sort of the daycare. You really need some... You need family support. It's not easy. I don't know we had long coverage hours back in those years, so you really needed, when you were on call, you were like in the hospital for the weekend or whatever, so you had to have some very good backup. It's not impossible. And again, understanding spouse and
the... And was the hospital receptive to taking helping you to...
Not really. I think it was, again, so individual if you could convince your chief of service or something like that. But I think it's pretty much accepted, and you don't have to bargain or negotiate or feel you're asking for something special and you go asking for special things. I would think nowadays that's not so, that you really, it's expected, and I think people would be hard-pressed to give you a hard time if you requested a leave or... Half-time, or...
There's not quite a few, but there's a number of women in my class, second-year class, who've had babies, and you know, there's an option to decelerate. If you want some, don't take it. Some do. So I think, and now I know that you can, when you're doing your matching for your residency programs, you can opt to share a residency with someone. And you can do it. You split the time half. I think I'm sure it takes longer.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can do that.
But it looks like that's already talked about. And again, you don't have to feel like, oh, I got to go bargain.
Right.
You know, I have to convince somebody to let me do this. And, you know, I think it was done, but it was on that level.
Yeah.
It wasn't something that, you know, you thought you could easily accomplish.
Which probably, the fact that it was set up like that probably fed into people saying, well, you know, women shouldn't really be doctors.
That's
and they're not really serious and all that sort of thing.
It's just going to take up a slot that some male could have.
Yeah.
Oh, and now I think it's about 50%? Women
yeah, that's UMass is pretty. It's just about 50.
Yeah,
just about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's a different time. Then I think you know, men, women perhaps were just gung-ho about making a lot of money, and I think some men going into certain professions were just you know interested in the practice of medicine, but also in making money. And, probably it's not as easy to make a lot of money as it used to be.
Yeah.
It gets a little bit harder. Back then who worked really hard could have huge practices and you know, collect a lot of money. But that's harder to do. Yeah. Did you, we had a women's society in medical, National Women's, I forgot the name of it, there was a group for medical students, like across medical schools. Is that still going on?
I'm not sure about like a national organization, if that's what you mean. I know at UMass there is an organization, Women in Medicine.
Uh-huh.
And we do have a chapter of the Student National Medical Association.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
We have that at UMass.
Uh-huh.
And so we've been actually this year the region has been pretty active in terms of getting so UMass actually hosted our regional conference for that.
Oh, great.
This year.
Because I think that's nice to be in touch with medical students from other medical schools to know what they're doing, and that gives you a broader network.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's
you know, because I have classmates like across the country, and it's fun to think, what city am I in? Who do I know? You know, that
exactly.
You can. I don't know if UMass tends to be Massachusetts, or people go everywhere.
I think people go to a variety of places. I know we have a program called the Learning Contract Program, which encourages students to stay in Massachusetts at least for 2 years, or I think it's now might be 4 years.
Right.
It's kind of a tuition deferral program where
right.
you defer a portion of your payment in return for service. So they do have that, and I'm not sure after that commitment how many stay in
Massachusetts.
Right. But I know the push and big encouragement is to stay here. But I'm sure there's UMass grads
all over the country. Yeah.
Sure.
Because in my class, people were coming from all over the country to Howard.
Yeah.
And, you know, very few were from D.C.
Okay. Are you from Massachusetts?
No, I'm from Oklahoma.
Oh, really?
So I come from Oklahoma to go to school
in
Washington. I met my husband there, who's from Massachusetts. So I'm back here.
Where did you do your undergrad?
Langston. It's a small college in Oklahoma.
Okay.
Yeah. Where are you from?
I'm from Boston.
Boston.
I'm from Boston, and I did my undergrad work at Spelman.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's a very, very popular school these days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my little sister's down there now.
And a couple of families, Kathy Taylor, and I don't know if you know that family.
Yeah.
Richard Taylor and Kathy Taylor, a daughter who's at Spelman. But I just know, just hearing from some of my friends, that it's gotten to be a very, very popular school. And it's an empowering kind of school, I think. It makes... women confidence.
Yeah, it was great. I mean,
yeah.
really loved it.
Yeah.
I did. Yeah.
It'd be interesting to hear about the, I hope things are different for women and women who are black in medicine these days. And,
I hope so too. I mean, I think some of the things you said are, you know, things have got to have changed over the years. I'm sure they're not where they should be.
Yeah.
You know, and how long it'll take for them to get there. I don't know.
I can remember some colleagues through the years, they would just be devastated, you know, when situations would occur rather than, I think, using your energies to figure out how you're going to solve the problem. If you can't move it, go around it, and, you know, but your goal is up here, and you're, and you can't let situations bog you down. So that
I know I've talked to friends and who are in medical school, and sometimes there's concern expressed about, you know, when you get into your clinical years, everything is can be very subjective. You know, and there's concern, well, you know, what if I don't feel like I'm being, you know, evaluated accurately? You know, do I say something, or who do I say it to, or if I say anything, am I going to, you know, mess myself up?
They're going to see you just complaining.
Yeah. How would you suggest that students deal with things like that?
I think you have to assess the situation, and I think there are instances when, you know, you see a window to raise it, and I think some people would say, oh, gee, you know, I'm sorry, I didn't mean it that way. On the other hand, I think you have to be prepared for people who won't listen and see you as being complained. And I think you have to look for another strategy. So I think you have to keep working at it until you find an appropriate solution, and I think it's so varied. And sometimes I think it's surprising. You would think somebody is more open than they wind up being. But I think you just have to keep on saying, okay, how can I get around that person? How can I build my support with somebody else who's more open? You know, if it's a feeling of more than one person, you know, to have several people voice the same kind of concern, and that makes it not seem so individual. But I think you're going to have to just have several strategies sort of in your bag of tricks that you bring forward to deal with it. You know, you don't feel that you can't find a solution.
I've heard other physicians and people say that you have to kind of choose your battles.
That's exactly right. And some, it's not worth fighting. Some, you know that, you know, you're right, but it's not worth fighting. That's absolutely true. To be seen as a whiner, too,
right? You know.
And one who always complains and always bringing the black issue up, I think you don't want to be looked at like that.
Right.
You know, but on the other hand, I think if you see something that's, you know, really horrible, you need to be willing to speak up about it. But yeah, you know, people are looked at as whiners and complainers. And,
okay, well, I think I need to kind of bring some
points,
but I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me. Is there anything that you want to add in terms of your experience here in Worcester?
I think Worcester is not a bad place to be, and I think there are a lot of open doors in Worcester, a lot of support in Worcester. So I think if you have any bad experiences, think on the positive side that there are a lot of open doors, a lot of people you can talk to or who would, you know, be willing to listen or really, on the other hand, be really supportive of a black woman in medicine and sort of help you move along the way.
Okay, yeah. Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, that's
a
match.
Thank you.
Good luck. And then go back to pediatrics. I never got back to pediatrics.
Okay.
I decided to go to child psychiatry. Pediatrics has really changed to do.
Yeah.